Acts 14, verses 21 to 25. They preached the gospel in that city and won a large number of disciples. Then they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the disciples and encouraging them to remain true to the faith. We must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God, they said. Paul and Barnabas appointed elders for them in each church, and with prayer and fasting committed them to the Lord, in whom they had put their trust. After going through Pisidia, they came to Pamphylia, and when they had preached the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. And then, 16, verse 1. Paul came to Derbe and then to Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived, whose mother was Jewish and a believer, but whose father was a Greek. The believers at Lystra and Iconium spoke well of him. Paul wanted to take him along on the journey, so he circumcised him because of the Jews who lived in that area, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. As they traveled from town to town, they delivered the decisions reached by the apostles and elders in Jerusalem for the people to obey. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and grew daily in numbers.
Well, we're moving on. We've been following the book of Acts, the second half of the book of Acts, and we're moving on through the book of Acts. We're also moving on with Paul and Barnabas, missionaries. Last week in Antioch, we saw how they were sent on their way to be missionaries and to go on a trip. And they went to a lot of different places, and we're not going to have time to look at all the different places that they went. But I want us just to take a look at that map again, if we can pull that up on the screen. And remember that Antioch over here was a big city. It was kind of the center from which Paul and Barnabas were sent off as missionaries. And so there are actually three people, at least, that we know about. Along with Paul and Barnabas is a young man called John Mark. And so they leave Antioch and they go to the island of Cyprus, which is over here. They land over here, they go across. The island of Cyprus is actually Amanda Kamarmi, who's one of our graduates, did some of her student teaching this year in Cyprus. And so anyway, that's where that is. They left Paphos, they went up to Perga, into this area. Then they went up to Antioch, the other Antioch. There's another, it gets confusing. You got Antioch over here, you got Pisidian Antioch over there. Then they went on down to the city of Iconium over there. And from there, they moved down to Lystra and Derbe, and then they returned and made kind of a backtrack eventually. That was the end of their first missionary trip. What we're going to be talking about today is this city here, Lystra. And actually, when they got over to Perga already, John Mark left, and from there on, he just said, this missionary gig is not for me. I'm not cut out to be a missionary for whatever reason. And so he went back on home, and so it was just Paul and Barnabas that went on the rest of the way. Well, now they're in the city of Lystra, and we're going to stop there for just a little bit and try to learn what messages might there be from that place that might apply to us, well, 2,000 years later, living here in Binghamton and worshiping here at Bethlehem Church. And I want to start just a little bit talking about the church and the city of Lystra. And the main thing about Lystra, in contrast to Caesarea, which we looked at 2 weeks ago, or Antioch, is what it wasn't. Caesarea was a big military center. Antioch was the third largest city in the whole Roman Empire at that day. Big cities. Lystra, small town, compared to the others anyway. Lystra has a mix of people. There are some Jews there. There was a Jewish population that had kind of scattered all through this whole area of what is today Turkey. There were Greeks there. Greece is over here. The Greek influence, of course, covers the whole region. But there were also still in Lystra, a lot of the people are from a little local tribal group. They're called the something or other. Lycaonians. The Lycaonians. That was a region called Lycaonia, a kind of a province. And so there were a lot of people that had been there, and they had that background of the Lycaonians. read about the book of Acts are big cities. The early missionaries went from city to city because that's where the people were. And it's interesting, too, when you look at mission history in the last, say, 50 years even, there's been a renewed emphasis that missions needs to impact the cities because that's where so much influence is. And so if you look, if you follow anything with, for example, Christian Reform World Missions, and some of the stories of the missionaries, think about Nigeria. Maybe some of you grew up with stories of missions in Nigeria. Missionaries would come back home in a mission fest in our church or something like that. And many of these missionaries initially went to small towns in the tribal areas of Nigeria. But the emphasis over the last years has now been to send more missionaries to the big cities because people are coming from the small towns, the tribal areas, and settling in the big cities, and there's so much change and so many people and so much opportunity. It's happening in the United States too. Christian Reformed Church started out as a lot of small town, rural churches and people. But it's fascinating, and I hope you get to hear some of the stories of what the Christian Reformed Church is starting to do in New York City. And you think of that city with its how many millions of people and that surrounding area with all kinds of ethnic groups, 100 and some different nationalities represented there. And the influence of if you start churches in these big cities and how then people are impacted, they go back to their own countries, they go back other places. It's a tremendous emphasis that we need to be grateful for and need to be aware of and supporting. But you know what? I'm awfully glad that the gospel is for the small towns, the little cities. I'm glad that the gospel is for a place like Binghamton, which is not the New York City. And I'm grateful that not only it is a city the size of Binghamton, that the Christian Reformed Church came here and didn't 45 years ago or whatever say, oh, that's not big enough, it's not worth going sending anybody here. Glad that they did. But I'm also glad that 125, 130 years ago, a little church in a place that's far smaller than Smithville Flats, which is hard to imagine, called Beaver Dam, Michigan, which really doesn't exist other than a church and a Christian school, and there were a couple of little stores, and there was a creamery at one time. But that's where I grew up. And there was a church there. And that influenced my life tremendously. And so the point of this church at Lifetime is that people everywhere need to hear the Lord. And it's an amazing thing. I think when Paul and Barnabas left Iconium, they had trouble there. A lot of places they did. They were kind of kicked out of town. And they went down to Lystra, and I think they kind of thought, oh, let's go to a smaller place. Maybe it's going to be a little bit more peaceful. Maybe it won't be quite as rough for us there. But I think they may have kind of wondered, is this kind of a detour? This isn't the kind of place we thought we were going to go. We were going to go to all the big cities. And what are we doing in this little town? But the amazing thing is that God doesn't have mistakes. And, you know, remember when Jesus started his ministry, Nathanael was told, we've met Jesus of Nazareth, and he said this, can any good thing come out of Nazareth, this little backwoods town of Galilee? Can any good thing come out of Lystra? Small town, not really important. Well, we read, Timothy lives there. Timothy, who later on became a very important part of the development of the church. There was no mistake as God sends Paul and Barnabas down to this place. And certainly, good things can come from this community and from this church just as well as anywhere else. So let's look at some of the things that we can learn from this church. Let's just consider some of the lessons that would be learned at Lystra. And the first thing I just want you to think about is the importance and the power of the gospel of creation. Now we're going to come back to this in a couple of weeks when we get to another big city, the city of Athens, because Paul talks a lot more about it at that point. But it's interesting when you read in Acts chapter 14 the story of what Paul did when he got to the city of Lystra. There's the only little part of his sermon that's recorded doesn't even mention Jesus, but it talks about creation. Now, I didn't ask Lawrence to read this part, but the earlier part of the story about Lystra is when they come to that village, there's a lame man who had been lame from birth, and Paul and Barnabas are talking, and they're sure they're talking about Jesus, and who knows what all else they're preaching about. But anyway, this man receives a healing, and he's able, after never having walked, he stands up and he walks, and he jumps, he's doing all kinds of things, and the crowd goes crazy. You got to remember what had happened. There's a tradition that in that area of Lycaonia, around Lystra, that some years and years before, two of the Greek gods, Zeus and Hermes, had disguised themselves and had made a little trip around that area of Lystra. And every house they went to, people just didn't accept them. Now, no, they didn't walk around with a big sign saying, I'm a god. You know, they just were incognito. But nobody except one couple welcomed them into the home. And you don't treat gods that way, even if they're kind of being sneaky and deceptive about the whole thing. And they were rather ticked off. And they destroyed most of the people in pretty much the whole area. And there was just this one couple that were left. Well, that was the myth that went around Lycaonia and around Lystra. And now all of a sudden these two strangers show up and they do a miracle. And the people said, well, you know, we can mess it up once, but we're not dumb. We're not going to mess up again. This must be Hermes and Zeus showing up again, giving us a second chance. And so we read that the crowd say, the gods have come back. They've come down again in a human form. And they start pulling all kinds of, they're talking Lycaonian. So, you know, kind of get the impression Paul and Barnabas aren't really sure what's going on here. All of a sudden they got this foreign language that people are talking Frisian or something like that. And they can't understand what's going on. But eventually they can tell that there's a crowd gathering and they're trying to bring sacrifices. They want to offer sacrifices. And boy, they finally get them to stop. They rush out and they say, why are you doing this? We're humans. We're just like you are. We're bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these old worthless idols of Zeus and Hermes. Turn to the living God who made heaven and earth and the sea and everything in them. And go on from there. But you notice they're interesting. Their message is not about Jesus in that setting. And I thought that seems strange because, you know, the people are already saying the gods have come down in human form. We think, what a logical and an easy just segue, right? Slide right into, well, let me tell you about the God who came down in human form. Tell me about Jesus. But they don't do that. And I think the reason for that is then you'd end up with just a, well, you've got your myth. I've got my myth. I believe Zeus and Hermes came down. You believe this Jesus was God, came down. Yeah, take your pick. Doesn't matter. They don't do that. But instead, Paul focuses on going back to the Creator and to creation. And that's what the people in that village, in that city, can relate to. And so he says, let me tell you about the living God who made heaven and earth and the sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all nations go their own way, yet he's not left himself without testimony. He's shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food. He fills your hearts with joy. These are all the good things that the Creator God has done and continues to do. God who created and God who continues to provide. And you know, in the most primitive society, because Lystra and the Lycaonians were still kind of living in their own primitive religious environment, or today in a most tech-savvy world that we live in, the fact is that people still are asking the question, where did I come from? Where did this whole business come into place? And Paul appeals then to the providential care of God for these people in Lystra. It says, you know, the God who made you has cared for you and still is doing that. You have food. There's rain. There's sunshine. There's crops. God made the world that way. And God's caring for you. And you know, that same fact is just as true today. In the rain that comes and the sunshine that comes and the crops that grow. And I think in our increasingly irreligious world, these issues still need to be addressed and need to be faced head on. And dare I say, even before you present the story of Jesus. Because these issues of, is there a creator? Is there a God who is directing things, working things for your good? That question is foundational. And it lays a foundation for the next step of telling the Jesus story. There is a God who made us. We messed it all up. But that God who made us still loves us and sent his son to the world to take the penalty and to do what we couldn't do. And that's where you get into the Jesus story. But, you know, if there is no God in the first place, if there is no creator, then life is meaningless. Then it's filled with absolute chaos and randomness. There is no moral compass if there is no God who is the creator. There's no reason to have a right or a wrong. There's no reason to do more than just advance your own interest. Everybody's for themselves. Each person's on their own. Do what you can, get ahead, because there's nothing else there. And you know what chaos and what horrible confusion life would be that way. The service so far this morning, in our opening call to worship, and the opening songs, and in the even the call to confession, has focused on praise to the Creator God. I just want to ask you, did you mean what you sang or what you said? Because this truth of creation lays the foundation for all that Paul later did and said in Lystra. No, we don't read a lot about it. We don't get all the stories written down for us. First point then. Second thing, and we look at Lystra, this gets switching gears, we switch ahead to chapter 16 with the story of Timothy. And it tells us that the family is such an important part of God's plan as he carries out what we ought to be doing in our world. Jump ahead. Acts 16 talks about Paul, and this is now the second trip. So this is maybe, well, we don't know exactly, 3-5 years later, something like that. Now it's Paul and Silas, not Paul and Barnabas, but Paul and Silas are going back and they're visiting some of the same places they had visited on the first trip. Only they're going backwards. So they start at Derbe, they end up at Lystra as the next place, and then they go up to Iconium and so on. But anyway, they get to the city of Lystra, and there's a disciple named Timothy, whose mother was Jewish and a believer, but whose father was a Greek. And later, this is the same person that Paul later wrote a letter to, and in 2 Timothy chapter 1, we read this part. He says about, I'm reminded of your sincere faith, which first lived in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I'm persuaded now lives in you also. Think of all the things that happened in Lystra, the healing of this lame man and other things. But I think the most important thing that happened in Lystra was the fact that there were two women and their young and the young son, grandson, who heard the gospel of Jesus. Because I'm sure Paul didn't just talk about the creation. I'm sure he also had opportunity to talk about Jesus. And they become followers of Jesus. This family was not a poster child for respectable Judaism. We read, we don't know anything about the grandmother, except her name was Lois. We don't know about her marriage. We know she had at least one daughter whose name was Eunice. And Eunice didn't stay in the Jewish faith. She married a Greek, which in many parts of Judaism would be enough reason to disown her completely. Lois doesn't do that. But they're kind of on the fringe of the Jewish community because everybody knew that Eunice was married to a Greek, an outsider, a Gentile. And they had at least one son whose name was Timothy. Well, we don't know his age at all of this. Perhaps a teenager, probably a teenager when the gospel of Jesus was first brought. But this whole family group, grandma, mother, and aunts, this boy, become followers of Jesus. And we just never know when the next important person in the history of church growth or church development is going to be impacted with the gospel. Paul and Barnabas take this sidetrack to this little town, And here they meet Timothy, who later becomes such an important part in the early church. The story of Billy Graham is a great story, and we all know, of course, about how wonderful a ministry he had and how many millions of people he preached the gospel to. But it would not have happened, humanly speaking, if it were not for a nameless or unknown to us traveling missionary by the name of Mordecai Ham, who had some meetings in this little area where Billy Graham was growing up. And somehow or other, God used that man in that place and impacted Billy Graham's young life, and he became the person that we have known about for the last umpteen years. And sometimes it's a traveling evangelist, sometimes it's growing up in a Christian home, in a community, with Christian parents and a good, solid Christian church. I think of the story of of Bill Hybels' childhood and his dad and going to a Christian camp and being challenged to personalize his relationship. And you know some of the story of the Willow Creek Association and how many churches around the world are impacted by that ministry now. But the impact of godly parents and godly grandparents cannot be overestimated. And as you look in your own life, if you are a parent or a grandparent, and you look at what is the important thing that I'm doing, the important things that you do with your life is not working hard so you can get a promotion, so you can have a bigger salary, or send your kid to a more expensive college, or that you somehow or other get just that advancement for your own ego, but how can I impact my children? And then later on, when you become grandparents, how can I impact my grandchildren? The covenant God is a faithful God. And hold on to that. Because, you know, as our children go through questions and they sometimes they get their rebellious streaks and sometimes they have their times of questioning and doubting. But God is a faithful God. And parents, you keep a relationship. And grandparents, you know, that's kind of the neat thing that we're trying to figure out. How can we be more hands-on grandparents when our grandkids are hundreds of miles away? But there's still that influence. And some of you have a very direct day-to-day influence on your grandkids because family is so important. The church is important too. We learned that from the story of Lystra. Somehow or other, church gets formed. In spite of the strange initial reception of thinking these are gods, Greek gods who are there, and then the dramatic turnaround, I didn't read about that. They finally get the crowd settled down a little bit so that they don't try to worship Paul and Barnabas and think they're gods. And then some other people, some Jews come down from Antioch and from Iconium, from the places where Paul had been before, and they win the crowds over. And all of a sudden everybody's turned completely against him, and the crowd, they stone Paul. They take him and drag him outside the city, and they throw stones on him. They think he's dead. In fact, they leave him there. And the other disciples, the ones that had started to be believers, they gathered around them. Oh, this is terrible. And Paul sits up. And he goes back into the city, and he goes on the next day. He says, well, there's enough time here in Lystra. And he goes on to Derbe and to the next little town. Somehow or other, in all of that business, a church gets formed in this small city. We don't know anything about it. There's no letter to the Lystrans. We just know that somehow or other, Timothy's family was a part of it. Mother, grandmother, Timothy. They're all there, and some others. Somehow people came to that personal faith in Jesus that said, we want to be part of this, followers of this Christ. We want to be known as Christians too. Paul eventually got around the topic of Jesus, obviously, because else it wouldn't be the church. But the point is, we're not going to be strong in Christ if we try to do it alone. And so, even in that family unit, it becomes part of a bigger circle. We need the community of the people of God. You don't do it alone. You can't go it alone. Paul knew the importance of leaving vital communities wherever he went. And so he gets to the end of his first journey, he gets to that city of Derbe, and after being there for a while and establishing church, he turns around and starts heading back to that same church as he'd been, and where we read this morning how they were strengthening the disciples and encouraging them to remain true to the faith. And they appointed elders for them in each church, and with prayer and fasting committed them to the Lord, in whom they had put their trust. Lystra, that happened to probably everywhere that Paul went later on in his journeys. He established left behind church leaders. And the point of appointing elders is not to say that our Presbyterian Reformed style of church government with elders and deacons is the only right way to do it. That's not the point. The point here is he was concerned that there be mature leaders, men and women in the church who would be able to mentor, who would be able to encourage, who would be able to help new believers, so that the church could be established and that Christians would be built up in their faith. The further story of Timothy was shaped and developed in that church community. When Paul comes back there, three, four, or five years later, the believers at Lystra and Iconium spoke well of Timothy. They knew him. He had been part of them. And Paul says, this is a good one to take along, and he takes them along from there on some of his other journeys as well. And this point about the importance of the church is that the surest way for you to shrivel up spiritually is to try to go it alone. To try to be on your own and say, I can do it all by myself. I don't need the church. I don't need the body of believers. And whether it's in the big city like Antioch or a small town like Lystra, Jesus is building his church. And he's doing that here in Cattellville. And if you withdraw and try to go it alone, you put your spiritual health at great risk. We have a couple of examples this past week of what happens when people think they can go it alone. Part of the tragedy of a Michael Jackson was that in his strange behavior, he pulled himself away from his family. And he had other people around him, but you wonder how much of the stories of what happened, and we don't know all the details, but were because he thought he was his own man, he did his own thing. He didn't have that family connection anymore. Or you think about the governor of South Carolina, all of a sudden just taking off, disappearing for a whole week, leaving his family, leaving the state. Like, I'm on my own, I can do my own thing, I don't need anybody, I'm not accountable to anybody else. And boy, you see the mess that has made. And so the church, the body, the community is so important. It may not be easy to face up to your weaknesses and your struggles and let other people in the church see that you are less perfect than you'd like them to think. But take the risk and let us have a chance to stand with you. That we are together in the hands and the heart of Jesus, and to be with each other, strengthening, encouraging, building each other up. It may have seemed for Paul that Lystra was a sidetrack. Why would I be sent there? But there are no accidents. There are no unfortunate detours in God's plan for Paul. There are no accidents in God's plan for the church, for us. There is no such thing as wasted time in God's perfect plan. And the question that you can ask yourself this morning is, what is God doing in my life? Maybe it seems like I'm on a plateau. Maybe it seems like I'm off on a detour. But what is it that God has in mind for me now? What is he doing that will work out for my good and that will work out for the glory of God? Let's pray.